Accession number 19927, Reel 1.
Major Dunning, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
In Southampton.
Which year was this?
This was in 1920.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Southampton?
Yes, I did. I went to an elementary school to the age of 12 and took the 11 plus, as it was called, and then went to grammar school, Taunton School, until I was 16.
So you left there in 36?
In 36.
Did you get a job?
Yes, my family were butchers, and so I went into business with my father. And he was of the old school. I had to start at the bottom as an errand boy, and then learning of cuts of meat and all that sort of thing. I did part-time musician then. I was very keen on playing the drums. And after 3 or 4 years, during which Munich had occurred, I decided I didn't want to stay in the business any longer and would join the services. And I should have gone to the 11th Hussars, the band there. But unfortunately, after I joined up in 1939, the war came along and the drafts out to the band were cancelled. So I stayed with the 12th Lancers. And so at the outbreak of war, I was a trooper in the 12th Lancers.
Why had you decided to go into the army?
Mainly, I didn't want to spend the rest of my life as a butcher, and wanted to a bit of an adventure and travel and get away really from the life I was leading in Southampton.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, I did indeed. We were in Wartburg Barracks, Aldershot. And I well remember we were on fatigues filling sandbags just outside. But at 11 o'clock on that morning, we were all up in the dining room and we heard that famous speech. Reminds me actually of Spike Milligan's account of it.
How did you feel about the news?
By and large, I felt like most youngsters, well, this is what has got to be done, a bit of heroic, a bit of adventure was in the offering, and didn't feel like one would do in later years. Felt like an ordinary 19-year-old who viewed it possibly as a bit of adventure and something that was necessary. I don't think I was an idealist at that stage. I didn't think of the politics of it, but vaguely that something ought to be done. I think it's worth remembering too the environment in which we were brought up on, and the country and the empire, and a sense of right and wrong, Queensbury rules and all that sort of thing.
What were your early experiences in the army like?
Well, initially I was in the band. In July I joined the band. I was really good at sports, and the first few weeks I did a lot of swimming and playing water polo, because it was the season for swimming and water polo. So I was taken off duties to swim and train and play in the band. That continued until the end of August. A very pleasant first few weeks, first few months. And then, of course, after the war had been declared, the 12th Lancers were one of the first to go to France. But as I wasn't an armoured car crew, or hadn't been trained in that, been in the band, they left me behind. And I was then seconded to a tank training regiment in Farnborough, where I became a clerk and helped in teaching map reading to recruits. So there I was until the end of that year, 1939, And then I was posted to Bulford as a corporal clerk to what was called the Tactical Training Regiment, RAC. And then I became an instructor and junior officers on map reading. And I was there when the fall of France occurred.
Did you see anything of the troops coming back from Dunkirk?
No, only a few, not noticeably. But it was that time, after Dunkirk, that the invitation, for want of a better word, came around in orders to volunteer for special forces. And it was there, at Bulford, when I volunteered for special services, which ultimately became commandos. It's interesting to reflect that the notice said volunteers wanted for special duty, able to swim, prepared to parachute, able to drive, and to serve in whatever capacity was needed, or words to that effect.
Which month was this?
This was July, beginning of July 1940.
So what was the procedure for your getting into it?
Well, it's quite interesting, really, because as I saw it then, my name went forward, and a captain of the Beds and Hearts came round and interviewed me. And I was a sergeant at the time, and no military qualifications were asked, whether I was a good shot or anything. It seemed to be just whether the officer liked my face and general bearing and attitude, and I was told I was in. And a few days later, I was posted down to what became Number 4 Commando at Weymouth, towards about the third week in July, as a sergeant and founder member of Number 4 Commando.
What was it called before it was called 4 Commando?
It was called 4 Commando, and then it got altered to Special Service Battalion in October, and then back to Commandos towards the end of the year.
What were your first impressions of the new unit?
There was a tremendous spirit. It's impossible to give one's own feelings about it without sketching in the background of what was prevailing at the time. The fall of France, Dunkirk, the imminent threat of invasion, that was the main thing on everybody's mind. The Jerry's would be invading. And nowhere was that more apparent than on the south coast of England, which Weymouth was on the extreme western flank. And what I think appealed to us, that we, instead of having to carry our onerous guard duties on the beaches, we would be called upon to strike back. And that's what really, I think, dominated our thoughts, having a go at Jerry. There we were, all young, keen. Well, we weren't all young. There were one or two volunteers who'd been in World War One, one or two officers, and one or two other ranks. Looking back, I've always maintained there were three categories of volunteers. One, the professional soldier who had pride in his profession and had suffered a defeat at Dunkirk and felt let down either by higher command or lack of equipment, etc. And he wanted to have a go, and volunteering for special forces would give him that opportunity. And then there was the second category, which I always maintain, were those idealists, some of those who thought Hitler had to be We'd had to get rid of Hitler and liberate people who had been offended, nauseated by his treatment of the Jews, and they were the idealists who were prepared for ideals. There weren't many of those, but what few there were became quite outstanding leaders. And then the third category were the young, adventurous and naive type like myself, who thought, well, here's a chance to do something daring, bold, exciting, parachuting, might go in submarines and all that sort of jazz. So all those sort of things, the feelings of those three types, the background of patriotism, Empire Day and all that sort of thing, swelled up in one and was very noticeable in those almost heady days of the birth of the commandos.
Whereabouts in Weymouth were you?
Well, a very important innovation of the commandos was that every single commando volunteer, officer and other rank alike, would not be stationed in barracks. They would be given a ration card, and in the case of officers, 13 shillings and fourpence, that's about 66p in today's money. Other ranks, all of them, from the RSM down to the private soldier, would get 6 and 8 pence a day, 33 pence. So with a ration card and money allowance, they would find their own billet and be responsible for quartering, feeding themselves, and they would have to be at the place of parade properly dressed and equipped for training. So that was an innovation, which was a very, very important factor. And of course, one of the reasons why the commandos were stationed at coastal places were not only would they get experience of boatmanship, but there would be a ready supply of billets with landladies available.
Did you say anything of the Battle of Britain?
Yes, indeed. Very noticeable. I mean, it's been recorded elsewhere, those lovely sunny days of late July and August with blue skies and crisscross of vapour trails. Actually, I've got a scar on my foot here where a little bit of macaque shell came, and because we were typical bravado and wouldn't go in the shelters if we were training on the beach, where you'd cheer the boys above. Saw a lot of the attack, the Battle of Britain.
Did you think the Germans would invade?
Yes, I did indeed. In fact, in the middle of August 1940, invasion was most imminent, we were taken off, number 4 commander was taken off of the special role which was we were training for, and placed under the command of the local commanders. Previously we'd been under direct war office command, but now we were put under the command of the local commanders and given the role for the defence of that particular part of Dorset. And our role was not a static one. We were supposed to be used as a mobile reserve to go and dash and repel any invasion wherever it came in the Dorset area. But there was one big fault about that. We had no transport. The only transport we had as number 4 commando was a vehicle for the CO and a 1500 weight truck for the admin officer. Some of the officers did have private cars and did somehow manage to beg, steal or scrounge petrol coupons. But apart from that, we had no transport. So how were we to be a mobile reserve? Well, our CO at the time was a chap called Lejard, cavalry officer, Colonel Lejard, quite a unique fellow. He'd been in the 1938 Olympic Games as a representative for the pentathlon team. And he had quite some unorthodox views about training. And anyway, he reckoned that the only way we could quickly become a mobile reserve was to get bicycles. So he let it be known that chaps could go out, beg, steal or surrounds bicycles or some other form of transport. But unfortunately, some of the methods used got to the attention of the police, and a parade was called, and all vehicles, bicycles, motorbikes, or even motor vehicles, which were not given to us voluntarily, i.e. been pinched, had to be returned. But the seeds were sown. He immediately after that got on to the Ordnance Depot at Tidworth and found there were 500 bicycles available up there. And we went by Sharabang, as they were called in those days, clad only in shorts and shirts. It was a lovely sunny day. And we went into one end of the Ordnance Depot and came out the other end pushing a heavy-duty WD bicycle, and then cycled back the 70 miles to Weymouth. Quite a venture, that.
What happened next?
Well, I think it's important to, on this anti-invasion roll, it was, I've forgotten the exact date, but it was about the 10th of September. We were on a Saturday night, we were all off duty, and of course, being off duty in no barracks, it was impossible to get in contact with us quickly. The only method was that we'd taken over the pier at Weymouth as our headquarters, where the orderly officer and orderly sergeant and sort of the others would be, and an order came through that we were to mobilise and go to the car park to, because an invasion was threatened. But the whole unit was scattered throughout the town in pubs, cinemas. They put on flashcards on the cinema to report with our weapons at the municipal car park, which was just behind the esplanade. But I'm sad to say it took about 3 hours. Meanwhile, about 11 o'clock, church bells were rung, and this was the signal that, under, I think it was regulation 81 or 51B, church bells would not be rung, only in the event of an invasion. But by midnight, we were more or less ready to take some action, and we stood to all night, but it was an absolute shambles, really. And it's interesting to read in Churchill's memoirs of that particular night, which a wrongly or misinterpreted code word had come out of the War Office, code word Cromwell, which meant that a invasion was imminent. It was misunderstood at some levels as that invasion had actually occurred, and hence the panic that there was, but it was a salutary lesson, and steps were taken to organise something better in the next few days, which it was, but it was a very salutary lesson.
How could you organise something better?
Well, having a better system of off-duty knowledge, where each troop would only, we were in 10 troops in that time, and each troop had to ascertain each night where people were, and they'd be back in their billets by 10 o'clock. So there's more control as there would have been in barracks. And that worked well, and we had one or two practice call-outs, and it worked well. The lesson had been learned. And then we all moved then out of Weymouth towards the end of September, while the threat was still on, to different dispersal points on the high ground behind Weymouth. And our troop went to Ridgeway Hill, which is a very prominent hill on the road from Dorchester to Weymouth, and carried out mock anti-invasion sorties on our bicycles and other training, night training. Yes.
And then?
And then the threat of invasion faded, and do you want a window open? During this time, of course, we were still training for our original role, weapon training, speed marches. But a change in philosophy was developing. I'll give you one example. Prior to 1939, 1940, all PT in the army was directed really on competitive games or PT with equipment, and invariably took place in a barracks gymnasium or on barracks square. But we, of course, had no barracks square, we didn't have any gymnasium. And when we first started, the drill was every morning, even during the anti-invasion threat, we would muster at 6:30 on the beach, do physical jerks and have a swim, and then go back to our billets for breakfast, then get kitted out in battle dress and what have you, and equipment, and carry on the normal training. What was obvious that PT was divorced from normal fighting. And we started to think about this and thought, well, we haven't got gymnasium, we haven't got all the horses and things like that, but what do we need that for? Do we need to play games? What we've got to do is to relate our PT to fighting. And we've got all the equipment, we don't need to change into PT shoes and all that sort of jazz. We've got to learn to do PT in our ordinary gear. And instead of horses, we've got fences to jump over. Instead of dumbbells and all that, dumbbells rather, we've got rifles for arm strengthening exercises. We can play piggybacks with our full equipment on, and so on. And so that was a radical change. One of the early influences which became known as commando training. The breaking away from training people to excel at sports and competition on the playing field to excelling on the battlefield. And that was reflected too in the weapon training, which was beginning to come through. We didn't have much ammunition in those days, and so it wasn't easy to get ranges or do shooting practice. But another instance, you see, we had no transport. Now, normally, troops in barracks and the infantry battalion, if they went to the ranges, which are always, of course, sighted well out of towns, where there's no risk of ricochets harming anybody. So the rangers are always far out of town. So they were at in the Weymouth area. And what little ammunition we had to, there are rifles and that, we had the job of getting to the rangers. So that was overcome by either marching out there or one expediency which troop leaders got to was say, right, tomorrow morning you've got to be at the range, which is at Chickerell, 6 miles away. How you get there is up to you. Be there at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning in your field service marching order or battle order with your rifles and take it from there. And this is all part of this initiative training, which became really a hallmark of commandos, chaps that would act on their own. And it's interesting to reflect on that. And that idea of people being told became quite a feature, I understand, of the OCTU, Officers Training Centres, training the young officers or cadets to be officers in initiative training. So that was an aspect of that particular early days. We did boating, but that was limited because we didn't have any landing craft. What we took into practice was some fishing boats, which were lent or requisitioned, rowing boats, but enough to start on boatmanship, but obviously no good for raiding. And so we carried on boatmanship and had quite some hairy experiences, because although the initial instruction said that all volunteers would be able to swim well, I'm afraid some of the chaps couldn't swim well, and there were one or two hair-raising experiences as a result of that. Right, so where do we get to? September. September came the first real coordinated training. Up until that time, each commando, where it was located, did its own sort of thing under the supervision of the colonel and the troop leaders. And then in September, No. 4 Commando became the first guinea pig commando to go to Scotland to train on purpose-constructed landing craft. And we went to a place called Inverary on Loch Fyne, which is a deep-water loch. And there, one of the two famous landing ships with assault craft were located. We were on the Glengyle, and we were introduced to landing craft, the assault landing craft, which held about 35 people. And this is a new experience. But there again, neither the Army or the Navy had worked together, and it was pretty chaotic. The feeding arrangements on board the Glengyle were terrible. It was a ship which had been converted. The lower decks, which were for cargo normally, had been converted to mess decks, and all ranks under the RSM were quartered down there, and hooks for hammocks were put up, and we had little what was called messes of 10 and fed then, but it was pretty diabolical. In fact, I've had sight of the old troop diary of that particular period, and the troop leader, Captain John of the Beds and Hearts, who I mentioned, records in that food was bad for the troops on board. In fact, the best food, and I quote, was the bully beef and biscuits and char, that's tea, brewed up on the shores when we went ashore for a day's training. And that's pretty well general. But the one thing about that, it was a blessing in disguise, because it sorted out the men from the boys, those that couldn't take it or bellyache and became moaners were sorted out. And when we got back after that particular training, we got rid of them. Because one of the features of commandos was that the CO could return to his parent unit any officer or other rank who wasn't making the grade without any compulsion at all. The threat of RTU was a real one, and a lot of those belly achers were RTU'd. They couldn't take it after the Inverary episode. And then after that, we didn't come back to the south. We went to Ayr and Troon and carried on our training there. We were often had operations which we trained for, specific operations, but invariably they were cancelled. And then Christmas 1940 saw us on the Isle of Arran, as with most of the commandos based there. And it was a pretty miserable Christmas set on the Isle of Arran. But training was carried on there, and from there, in the January, three commandos went off to the Middle East on a operation which was to capture Pantelleria, and this is the January of 41, and we carried on training in Troon and Ayr, and then in March, or the end of February, we were taken away with Number 3 Commander, and we did the first Lofoten raid on the 4th of March 1941.
Can you take me through that raid, as far as you remember it, as far as it affected you, please?
Yes. I was sergeant in F Troops, still at that time, and we boarded a ship, the Princess Emma, I think it was, at Gourock, and were briefed that we were going to go to do a raid in Norway, and we had some Norwegian